Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, April 8th. Today we learn about efforts to launch a new independent registry for the tens of thousands of families who may have been impacted by fuel-contaminated drinking water at Red Hill. The challenges of fresh fish. We learn what's on the wish list of a local nonprofit that rescues food to get to other groups like the food bank or soup kitchens. Invasive grasses helped fuel the Maui wildfires last August. So how did they get here, and what can we do to replace them with native species? We also hear about the Lattice Stones of Guam. Did you know they now grace the area at Bishop Museum? It's part of FESPAC and an effort to repatriate archaeological items taken from the Mariana Islands decades ago. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Tens of thousands of families who may have been impacted by fuel-contaminated drinking water in the Navy's water system are being encouraged to take part in a webinar that takes place tomorrow at 9 a.m. It is the second one held by the DHA, the Defense Health Agency. It'll be a chance for families to ask questions and get updated on the latest efforts that are underway. We talked to Colonel John O. He's the chief of the Occupational and Environmental Division of the DHA in Virginia about the meeting.
We have about 39,000 subscribers to what we call Defense Health Agency Public Health Red Hill e-updates. And in addition to that, you know, we're just trying to get the word out through all of our contacts within DOD, CDC, Hawaii Department of Health, you know, anyone else who might have an interest. It's an open webinar, so anyone can dial in.
Well, there may be some interest just because of the recent concerns that have come up about the tests of the drinking water. So, yeah, folks might want to listen in if they haven't signed up already, you know, on this outreach.
Sure.
So I guess for the folks who aren't familiar with what the military has been doing to address the concerns of the families who have been exposed to something in the water, whether it's fuel or something else, what are the efforts that are underway?
So I agree with Admiral Wade, who, as you know, recently stepped down. He was the Joint Task Force Red Hill commanding officer. You know, when he was in his position, he has stated on several times that Red Hill should not have happened, you know, but we can't turn back the clock. I think by the Navy's own investigation, Red Hill happened because there's a failure of to live up to Navy standards. So that said, as you know, the Red Hill fuel release exposed tens of thousands of individuals in Hawaii to JP5 aviation fuel and fuel additives in the drinking water in areas served by the Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam water system. And many of those people were more than 2 years out. Many of those people are doing fine now health-wise. We know some that aren't doing as well, and there are some that have significant problems with their health, their quality of life, their overall functional status. And so I think we owe it to the community of exposed individuals as well as the greater Hawaii community to really try to be honest and transparent, to share what types of efforts we're doing at Defense Health Agency, you know, to try to support the population of the people that were exposed to the fuel release.
I did attend an open house meeting early on, and when the Secretary of the Navy, Carlos de Toro, was there, you know, he was asked about, you know, nursing moms, whether there would be any kind of a system to track the health of those mothers or those babies. Is there anything like that?
Yes. I think everyone would be understandably very concerned about children who were not born yet during the time of the fuel release, you know, children who were being breastfed at the time, and even, you know, younger children who are developing, and they're considered, you know, vulnerable populations. So I think that's something that everyone has concerns with. Now, within DOD, we do have a Red Hill registry that has about 55,000 individuals. These are all DOD affiliated. So what that means is it includes service members, including Air Reserve, Army Reserve, National Guard, Air National Guard. It would include their family members, civilians that are employed by DOD, contractors who work with DOD, military retirees. But it doesn't include Hawaii residents who don't have a DOD affiliation. And our DOD register has limited functionality, so we don't have the ability to provide serial ongoing monitoring of health through questionnaires over the years ahead, which is really what an exposure registry is all about. And so one of the things we're really committed to in DOD is to support an independent Red Hill registry, an independent registry that would be operated by a party external to DOD, that really would have full latitude to plan and execute the registry to support the population of exposed individuals, and to really do the kind of research so we can understand what may be the long-term health effects from the fuel release. So the DOD registry that I mentioned that has 55,000, those individuals, there was no real signing up. We actually obtained rosters of people who lived in military family housing, as well as workers that worked at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. In the vast majority, I'd say 99% of individuals in our DOD registry were captured automatically. We filled out the rest through basically inviting anyone who was not captured to basically contact us, and if they met the eligibility criteria for being in the registry, we included them. The independent registry that I referred to, it is not ready for enrolling. We will be publicly announcing that in short order. We're trying to put the finishing touches on some of the planning and the funding. So there will be an announcement of this in due course. That will be different, though, because you really will have to volunteer. It will be opt-in. If you don't register, you won't be included in the independent Red Hill Registry. So it's going to be very important that people take advantage of that at the right time.
And as far as the criteria, so you probably have to be living in those neighborhoods when they had the spill or the unusual test results of the drinking water?
Right. So the independent Red Hill Registry, the eligibility criteria will be those that lived, worked, attended school or daycare in any part of the water system that was served by Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam from the dates November 20, 2021, through March 18, 2022. And those days correspond to the known fuel release at the Red Hill Bulk Fuel Storage Facility and the last date that the last neighborhood was given the all clear sign and the Hawaii Department of Health lifted the public health water advisory. Now, I've spoken to individuals that didn't live in Hawaii during that time period, but they said that they lived there prior to 2021 and they had concerns about the water. And we know that the Red Hill fuel release that occurred on November 20, 2021 wasn't the only fuel release at the Red Hill Bulk Fuel Storage Facility. Many people are aware that Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or ATSDR, they're conducting an ongoing public health assessment to really look at what might be some health risks from any prior fuel releases. We also know that there are some that are concerned about the water right now. And I know that there's been a lot of concerns about the detection of total petroleum hydrocarbons, or TPH, and what are some of the health risks of that. For right now, the independent Red Hill Registry will really focus on those that we know were exposed to the JP5 fuel release and the fuel additives during that time frame I referenced. And I think a future decision about any individuals served by the water system before and after that time period will have to be done at a later date once we know a little bit more.
Okay. All right. But those are some of the things that you'll be covering at this webinar.
Right. I think the webinar, I'll have a few updates to share on the independent Red Hill Registry, a forthcoming independent expert consensus study report, some of the needs for Red Hill-related research. I'll talk briefly about the Red Hill Clinic, but most of the time that we'll spend in the one-hour-long webinar, we'll just be answering questions that are submitted by individuals through the webinar platform.
We've been hearing from Colonel John O, who is with the Defense Health Agency in Virginia. It's hosting a second webinar with families who may have been exposed to fuel or additives in their drinking water dating to the spill of 2021. We'll hear more right after a short break.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Dr. Judith Orloff, author of The Genius of Empathy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to embody your most authentic, fierce, and compassionate self.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Malama Ola Health Services on Oahu, offering individualized hospice and palliative care 24/7 to patients in their residence, nursing home, or other setting. 808-543-1188.
Let's get back to a conversation we had with the Defense Health Agency. It's to hold a meeting tomorrow with families connected to the Department of Defense who may have been impacted by fuel-contaminated drinking water. The webinar will be available on demand if families can't log on in real time. Here's Colonel John O.
We know that military families typically will stay in Hawaii. Like, the active duty tour is generally about 36 months or 3 years. And so just based on our own data, we found that about half of those families have left Hawaii already. And when we talk about an independent Red Hill Registry, it's very important that it be worldwide because families depart Hawaii. And over the course of the next years and even decades ahead, you know, they will literally be worldwide.
Well, I did talk to one mom who has since transferred out of here, and she was just concerned. She says, you know, I said, how's your health, you know, since you left Hawaii? And she said, well, I've come down with diabetes. And she said, but nobody in my family has diabetes. So we're all wondering, you know, could something that I had in the water trigger this? And so you just don't know.
That's right. That is one of the major challenges. As you know, there are estimates that upwards of 90,000 individuals were exposed to the fuel release and any associated fuel additives, byproducts. Whenever you have a population, 90,000, people are going to develop medical problems. And I think the real question for epidemiologists is to determine whether or not the medical problems that occur in the cohort, meaning the population of individuals exposed to the fuel release, would be higher than, let's say, a comparison population. And that is an area of ongoing interest in studying. For example, we know that there are some other military bases in Hawaii, such as Schofield Barracks and Marine Corps Base Hawaii in Kaneohe, that were not on the Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam water system. And that serves as a potential comparison population where we can look at the health going forward.
I see. Okay. You can do it that way. The webinar will be available if people can't watch it in real time. It will be available online afterwards.
That's right. We know that 9 o'clock in Hawaii on a Tuesday morning may not work if you're working. We'll have the webinar recorded and people can view it later on demand. This will be our second webinar. We did this in January, and you know, if people want to look at the format, they can go to our Red Hill Public Health website and look at an archived version of the January webinar.
Okay, and then the details on that second independent registry, how soon would those details be forthcoming?
Well, I really hope we can talk about that soon. I'd say hopefully within the next month or so. Not just the independent Red Hill Registry, but the independent expert consensus study report. I think at this point, since we are still in some areas of ongoing active planning, negotiation, it involves, you know, some funding dollars. I can't get into a huge amount of details in terms of being specific about who will be rewarded the agreements to operate the Red Hill Independent Registry, as well as this independent experts consensus study report. But we think that the independence is very important. We know, and I've talked to a number of individuals that, you know, they've really lost a lot of trust in DOD. And I think it's very important. Frankly, you know, I know there are some folks that no matter what I say, because I'm a representative of the Department of Defense, they're not going to believe a word that John O says. And so I think that's why it's very important to have an independent expert, you know, brought to the table to really help support this community in the long run.
Okay, so that independent entity, though, they have not started anything?
They haven't started officially, but there's been planning. Okay. That's ongoing. to think through how a registry, an exposure registry such as this would operate.
Okay. And I imagine that will entail like blood tests or, you know, those kinds of things?
I think the main thing that an independent Red Hill registry will include is serial questionnaires. You know, when CDC-ATSCR publicly briefed the results of their second assessment of chemical exposures survey, this would have been in November of 2022, they referenced the Flint registry as a model for DOD. So Flint, as many people know, is referring to the 2014 contamination of the water system by lead, and it exposed, I think, upwards of 100,000 individuals, many of them children, to contaminated lead in their drinking water. And they've also referenced other environmental exposures registry, like the World Trade Center registry. And so really the core piece of these exposure registries are serial questionnaires that are administered to the population that's in the registry. I think any decisions in terms of biomonitoring, which is what you're referring mm-hmm. to in terms of lab samples, urine, et cetera, I think that's not something that is currently planned at this time, but I think we would have to see, you know, which way the evidence evolves.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And, you know, on that trust thing, I know there are families that I've heard speak at some of these forums where they just have not signed up and gone to the clinic because they don't trust what's going on there and have gone outside, you know, whether it's to Kapi'olani Women's and Children's or somewhere else and have, you know, paid out of pocket just because they want to know, you know, what's going on. You know, why am I feeling this? You know, why am I getting sick?
Yeah, and I've talked to several individuals exposed to the field release, and I fully acknowledge some of the frustrations that people have experienced. I've had some individuals tell me that, you know, particularly those that have moved away from Hawaii, that they'll see a new doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they will tell the new doctor that, you know, they've got a number of you know, symptoms, sometimes brain fog, headache, tingling, you know, dizziness, skin problems. And they'll relay that they were exposed to the field release at Red Hill, and their new doctor will give them a deer in the headlights look, saying, "What's Red Hill?" And that's very deflating, you know, for patients to have healthcare providers that really don't know a lot about Red Hill. We're trying to address that in our military health system. I mean, we have a military health system that's global. We really don't want to have a situation like that. We want to make sure that, you know, our healthcare staffs are postured so that when there is a patient that comes in with complex symptoms, you know, related to Red Hill, that the health system is really there to provide the best patient and family-centered care possible.
That was Colonel John O. with the Defense Health Agency in Virginia, who we talked to Friday afternoon. Again, that webinar to ask questions begins Hawaii time at 9 a.m. It will be available online to view later as well. We'll have links to join on the conversation page of our website later today.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
Movement is good for the body, but did you also know it's good for the brain and can help for people suffering from dementia? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about how dancing may just do more than move your feet. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
ever wonder what happens to unsold fish at the fish auction? Well, just recently, the nonprofit Aloha Harvest began rescuing that fish. Its mission is to help get surplus food from food establishments into the hands of families who are food insecure. Brandon Tomita is executive director, and he's on the lookout for someone with fishmonger skills.
This year, we actually set up a partnership with the United Fishing Agency, which runs the fish auction, and the Hawaii Longline Association. To rescue any unsold fish, you know, local caught fish, of course, we're really excited about that. Allows us to get a protein source. One thing that we kind of knew was going to be an issue is, of course, these fish are coming straight from the auction. So they're whole fish, you know, generally going to be probably about 50 pounds. But these fish have the head and tail on, you know, they're gutted, but there's some work that has to go into getting it ready for prep. And so kind of in the lead up to this, we start to ask the recipient agencies out there, hey, who can handle, you know, fish processing and can you break these fish down? As we start to pick up the operation, we're finding, as expected, you know, there's a certain limit that each recipient agency can handle, and at a point where they said, hey, we have more than enough fish, it's going to take some work. We're trying to figure out, okay, what's our best way forward to make sure that we can process these fish or get them in the right hands in a timely fashion. So what we're looking for is potential partners. You know, one of two things can happen. One, we'd be really interested as a team here with Aloha Harvest. If someone would want to partner with us to break the fish down, of course, but also to kind of teach anyone that we may have, either employed or volunteer force, to help us learn how to safely and correctly break these fish down. You know, so we can take multiple pathways of getting this fish in the right hands. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a, you know, opportunity to get this out to a little wider audience. We, of course, are reaching through our network saying, hey, if you know anyone who works with fish, can help instruct or can help break some of these down for us, we are more than happy to get anyone who's interested involved in this project.
What kind of fish are we talking about?
So these are going to be some of your smaller swordfish, and maybe some ahi, big eye, or tombo. These are going to be fish that are probably an average of about 40 to 50 pounds. So not small, but, you know, not the gigantic fish that you might see at auction in the usual picture. But yeah, still sizable, still a lot of work that has to go into it, and still some education for us to learn how to handle it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a skill. It's an art.
It is. And I've gotten pretty deep into some YouTube videos watching various fish cutting techniques, but, you know, nothing beats actual instruction in how to get it done.
Okay. And so then the fish and the food that you're able to rescue, I mean, those are just leftover things, let's say, at the end of the day from a bakery or, you know, someone who's got excess of some types of fruits or vegetables?
Yeah, so we actually can take food donations from a number of different donor types. We have stores that, you know, get stock product to us before their sell-by date. We have restaurants, as you mentioned, who may have either stock items or prepared food that, you know, is still usable. We can also get from farms. This fish auction opportunity is great. We can get it straight from the org who's bringing it into our shores. And then we get it to community recipient agencies. That could be a church, that could be a food bank, that could be a nonprofit who is helping get food into the hands of the food insecure.
Where do these food donations go to? I mean, do they go to the soup kitchens, churches? How does that work?
Yeah, so our trucks, we do have a fleet of vehicles. We'll pick up from the donors and then we'll get them to the site. So as you mentioned, that could be a food bank, that could be a church, that could be a shelter. And we're generally going to be doing that day of, because we don't have our own storage facility. We do have partners who we can rent out some space from for, you know, larger donations. We do have some great partners like Foodland Hawaii, who has, you know, pallets of items that they'll get into our hands so we can get it to the community. But generally speaking, we're going to be getting items, picking it up in the morning, and then by the afternoon, getting it into the hands of our recipient agencies.
I mean, that's terrific, because, I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, perishables, mm-hmm. and the need is great. I mean, we saw what happened with the pandemic, right? And we saw all the produce from the farms, that kind of thing, and it was nice to be able to help out those farmers and then help the people who were in need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lots of good lessons we learned from the pandemic and lots of good relationships, I think, that our community has built up and strengthened, I think, during that tough time.
Yeah, and we are excited to work with whoever else is in the community. There are organizations that do similar items to what we do, but also, you know, anyone who is a potential donor or even a potential recipient, we are more than happy to work with whoever wants to address rescuing food to help feed the food insecure.
And then do you need more volunteers? I mean, this is Volunteer Month.
You know, that's funny because we have a great volunteer network. We are always welcoming more volunteers, whoever is interested. One of the programs that we're working on that has, you know, slowly built up is our community harvest program. This is something that is pretty popular. And what we do is we actually go to, it could be a house even, it could be someone's house. Let's say you have a big avocado or a big mango tree, and it's pretty hard to manage on your own. We'll go out there and we'll help you pick that fruit and, you know, take that donation, again, through the normal pathway that we have, get it into a recipient agency's hand in order to be able to make sure that we're not wasting that fruit, we're actually getting it to those who can use it.
Oh, that's a great idea because, you know, I drive around the neighborhood too and we see trees and sometimes, you know, the owners are elderly and they're not going to climb up that tree, you know, to harvest the fruit. And it's a shame when it does fall it just, you know, rots, and you like to get it into the hands of somebody who could use it.
Yeah, so we have companies that will ask us if they have any volunteer events. We have, you know, individuals, and something like that is a great experience. It gets you outdoors. It gets you some activity. You know, you're not stuck in our office labeling pans or anything. It's something that I think people can appreciate without having to do it on a daily basis.
The one thing, I guess, that I'm wondering about is there that much fish then being caught that we have a surplus down there at the fish auction?
Yeah, you know, I think the conversation leading up to this, it was interesting because there were a couple of things that allow us to now be able to rescue fish. Number one, you know, the pandemic did see, unfortunately, some closures of restaurants, but also Maui. The after effects of Maui, what was brought to our attention is that some of the fish that is or would have been sold to some of the restaurants, you know, down on the waterfront, that was fish that's now available because those restaurants aren't operational. And so I think what we're seeing some of the effects of these unexpected circumstances, and now, you know, we're given the opportunity to help the community and help the entities, you know, not waste these fish that they're catching.
Okay. All right. Well, again, your need right now is for someone with the skills to cut fish and break it down so that it's more manageable as you get it into the hands of the people who do need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if there's a question of, well, great, you know, I'm a trained fish cutter. How do I get in touch with you? You can reach out through our website, alohaharvest.org. There's going to be a link in there that, you know, a volunteer link would actually work, or just our general info at alohaharvest.org.
Okay.
You can reach out that way and the message will come to me. So,
okay.
Yeah, we really appreciate this opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you. And mahalo for the work that you do in our community. But thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you, Catherine. I really appreciate it.
That was Brandon Tomita with Aloha Harvest, who is looking for someone to partner with the nonprofit to break down large fish from the fish auction here on Oahu. Aloha Harvest marks its 25th year serving our community.
Psychometric screenings are becoming common in hiring. What are they?
Predicting whether somebody can do a job that they haven't done before, or whether somebody is likely to learn a skill that they haven't actually displayed or learned before.
I'm Amy Scott, assessing your inner potential, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Flammable invasive grasses like bufflegrass and guinea grass were found to have fueled the Maui wildfires. In the aftermath, many have wondered if there's anything we can do to replace these non-native grasslands with fire-tolerant native grasses and shrubs. It's an issue that's going to be hard to uproot. This month, the National Interagency Fire Center reported that Hawaii has above normal potential for a significant wildfire this spring and summer. Stephanie Jelinek is a rangeland scientist with the U.S. Forest Service who has conducted research into invasive grasslands in Hawaii and several western states, as well as in South Africa. She spoke to The Conversation's Maddie Bender about a new study she led on invasive grasslands on Hawaii Island and what it could mean for efforts to reseed landscapes with native species after a destructive fire.
Is there a single or main historical narrative as to how all the invasive grasses got here?
You know, I've been kind of digging into the history a little bit of the introduction of non-native grasses to Hawaii. And as you may know, like, cattle were brought over as a gift to King Kamehameha in the late 1700s. And it wasn't until I think the mid-1800s that ranches started coming about because foreigners were then able to own land. So there's like a series of events that have moved towards pushing towards the agricultural perspective. And I found a technical report that was dated as 1937. And I think by that time, already 140 species of grasses they had characterized. And they had in the back of that document, like, when was it brought and for what purpose? And so some of them were purposeful. A lot of them were purposeful introductions for forage. Some of them were accidental. People used to not be so great about biosecurity. And so sometimes seed lots weren't pure, and you might get something that you didn't want in your seed that you were bringing over for forage. They came on the coats of animals. There's been pulses for sure, but I think there's also been a steady drumbeat. And then, you know, there's a few species that were brought over for horticultural reasons. So fountain grass, for example, was actually brought over to look pretty. And now it's just wreaking havoc.
So let's turn now to the study. And I was reading the paper, and I wasn't expecting the Department of Defense to come up as maybe a potential inspiration.
The Department of Defense had not too long before purchased the Keamuku Maneuver Area, which they had added on to Pohakaloa Training Area to increase the land on which they could train. And it had been Parker Ranch land, so it had been grazed for quite some time. And once they were on the ground, the story I heard was they noticed a lot of erosion. And so this study came about from trying to figure out which grassland ecosystems would grow back the fastest. Because when you have roots in the ground of your plants, you tend to have less erosion. So that's the very small scale view, but like moving out from there in a more like general ecology kind of question, you know, we just had questions about if we disturb these landscapes, is the next invasive species going to come in and replace what was there before? Is it going to turn back into the same thing? Like, how can we get predictive in this world in which we live, in which there is so much disturbance from lots of different angles, you know, whether it's bulldozers or tanks, I guess, or cattle or fires, you know, like, what do we expect to see on the other side of that? The site offered a place that had been long disturbed, had a lot of invasive species that we didn't feel so terrible running over with a bulldozer, I guess. But also, you know, they really kind of capture a range of invasive grasses that are problematic across the different islands. And yeah, like the Mauna fire did burn over some of our study areas, and I was able to go back as a part of a field trip with the Society for Rangeland Management. They had a meeting, the California Pacific sort of section of the society had a meeting in Waimea, and they took us on a field trip, and I was like, wow, this is my old study site. And it looked exactly the same. Like, I mean, you know, little ali'i and, you know, some of the other native shrubs, ilima coming back, but really in a sea of that same sort of non-native grass species.
That kind of brings me to my next question. So this question of what happens to invasive grasses when a disturbance occurs.
Right. We kind of discussed the difference between colonizers, which are species that tend to get there really fast. So maybe they just pump out a lot of seed. They tend to germinate really quick and grow really fast. But then sometimes during the course of succession, they may fade out and be replaced with with your more competitive species. And so what we found is that often we were seeing the same species show up afterwards, and sometimes it shifted a little bit, and it sort of suggested that some of these species are more on the competitive side of things and might be there in the longer term. Some of them were more on the colonizer end of things and might be there more in the short term. But overall, the species composition of a site really kind of went back to the same basic assemblage, and it was the rate of coming back that was dramatically different. So with kikuyu grass, which is rhizomatous, which means that it grows from runners, it was able to come back super quick. Like, we came back 2 months later, and our plots were already 100% grass.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of those slower-growing species, which tend to be slower-growing because they're in those hotter, drier sites, so things like buffel grass or fountain grass, those tended to be just have a lot more bare ground through the study, and so they were just coming back slower. But again, like a similar species composition at the end.
And what are the implications there for efforts to seed regions destroyed by things like fires, other natural disasters with native seeds? I mean, these are topics that are front of mind for a lot of people right now.
To me, it says, you know, so we have those plots that were, you know, beforehand they were dominated by non-native grasses, and we saw some of those native shrubs come back. You know, the ilima, the a'ali'i, and then they just kind of blinked back out. So they were outcompeted by the grass, kind of grown over, and they didn't make it through. But where we had a large seed source of those, so in plots that had started out dominated by native shrubs, they managed to hang on afterwards, right? And so what that kind of tells me is it's the number of seed. And so even if you think the seed are getting there, the degree to which we can up the ante and really shift the needle in our favor just from a basic probabilistic perspective. And I think, you know, people have been doing this for a while, and part of the issue with seeding post-fire, post-disturbance is the supply chain. You know, there isn't a lot of commercial industry that just grows out seed for restoration. I was a little bit flabbergasted after 10 years of living and working with managers in Hawaii, you know, where they handpick seed on site. So in Kauai Volcanoes National Park, for example, they kind of have built a management program expecting the next fire, I guess I would say. And so they have refrigerators that are full of seeds of different things that they think they might need into the future. So after the Keaho fire in 2018, they were ready with seeds. But most organizations don't have that because they're not commercially available. And then I get, you know, to the Great Basin in Reno, and it's like you can just buy seeds of native plants. Like, I should have known this, but it was still very surprising to me because I had worked so long in the absence of that. And so I think folks are moving towards that direction so that they can go in and reseed large areas. There's talk of aerial reseeding, helicopter reseeding from both helicopters and airplanes. But yeah, the supply chain needs to be there. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the bottleneck at this point, I think.
Native seed banks didn't have the supply, as you were saying, and so it hasn't really been possible to reseed in Maui.
Yeah. No, I think the knowledge is there, and I think it has been for quite some time. I'm going to be frank. I love doing restoration research, and I'll do it forever, but the knowledge we need is there. We kind of know what to do. It's more creating the capacity to do those things on the ground. And so in places that are closer to sea level, you just tend to have more long-term disturbance over time. There's fewer native species around for seed to be there in the first place. So there would be no expectation that these things, you know, like these places that burn over, unfortunately, you know, my expectation is there, whatever you saw before, that's what's going to be there after. So if you want to see something different, yeah, a management strategy needs to be in place.
You could maybe also look at these results and say, oh, there are certain species that take longer to rebound, like invasive species. So maybe if what you're trying to do is a short or midterm solution and you have limited resources, thinking about like strategically where those would go.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, looking at this study, buffel grass grew back pretty slowly. So what that means to me is you have a larger window of time where there's open bare ground for you to figure out what is the seed we're going to buy. How do we get that on the ground? Do we have the grant money for that? So it does lend a little bit of predictability to that post-disturbance window into which restoration practitioners and land managers can work if they want to put seed down.
Is there anything else on the topic of this study or habitat restoration, reseeding with native seeds, that you want to mention that you feel like we haven't yet got into?
I mean, just that planting is also an option. There are nurseries that grow out native plants, and the cost-benefit analysis is a little bit different because plants are expensive, but they are more likely to survive than a single seed. So, you know, it's a little bit of bet hedging. If you think that you can plant out 100 plants and they make it to adulthood and create their own seed, that then you've kind of worked in your favor. And, you know, there's plenty of examples. I would say more at mid and higher elevation areas where there's numerous management agencies that have been replanting native species into non-native grasslands for quite some time. And so there's a huge, you know, on-the-ground knowledge base. There's a research knowledge base that exists for people to pull from, especially in terms of planting. And so, you know, not to rule that out. I know it's expensive, but the success rate's pretty high.
That was Stephanie Jelinek from the USFS Rocky Mountain Research Station talking to The Conversation's Maddie Bender. Jelinek's paper was published last month in the journal Ecology and Evolution. Look for a link to it on the Conversation page of our website after the show.
When you support HPR, you support community reporting about community issues.
It's been more than 8 years since a group of families from Ha'ena Kauai established the Ha'ena Community-Based Subsistence Fishing Area. The community creates rules regulating catch limits, size limits, species limits, and more.
With your support, HPR brings you voices from our island communities.
It's a tool that makes sure that we can keep on practicing and fishing the way we did, and not excluding folks, but saying like, hey, if you like come fish in this area, this is how we fish, this is how we take, this is how much we take.
It's got to be community driven, got to be from the people of the place. They know their place better than anybody.
Support local reporting on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Maddie stones are stone carvings native to Guam and the Mariana Islands and their indigenous people. They're seen as a sign of their identity, and for the first time in 30 years, they'll be on display at the Bishop Museum. To give us more context, HPR reporter Kessie Ordonio is here. Good morning.
Good morning. Hafa day, Catherine.
Yes,
thanks for having
hafa
me.
Day. You know, just so our listeners understand, lattice stones, I mean, I grew up, you know, knowing them as architectural features. We used to build our huts on top of it, you know, the hale, right? And so they were very high above the ground, which is smart when you think about climate change. But share with our listeners, you know, what they look like.
So for listeners who don't know what lattice stone look like, think of it as maybe a chalice cup or maybe even a sake set. So you got the pillars that are kind of thinner at the bottom and the capstone, which is at the top. So that architectural design was made to basically house the homes that are typically made of wood or other leaves to make the foundation of a home. But the term lati actually means scab. So, you know, when you get a cut and then a scab forms over it, that's basically what lati means. But the Chamorro word or the Tamoru word is actually latu. And latu means to heal, so you kind of think of these stones as these healing stones. And at these lati sites that you'll see in Guam or Guahan or the Mariana Islands, sometimes our ancient Chamorro ancestors would bury their loved ones right there, just so they go through these times of healing in this process. So latu to heal. But these stones in particular at the Bishop Museum, I mean, they're displayed right now. They're in yellow tape. There's no sign display yet. The curators and Chamorro folks are, they're still working with it on setting up the display a little bit more nicely to let the public know about these stones.
And so they're on display in like near the Great Lawn?
kind of near the Great Lawn, but it's more closer to Hawaii and Pacific Hall. So it's kind of like a slanted area closer to the science exhibit. But these stones, how they're set up, they're not your typical lattice stone that you typically will see in Guam or the Marianas. The caps are actually, they're kind of spread out in a circle, but the curators did this on purpose. And I spoke to Elissa Santos, who's a Chamorro from Guam, and she was part of a program from East West Center. And she's always known that those stones were there. And this was her reaction when she first saw them.
It was a bittersweet moment, I think, for all of us, because, of course, you know, who wouldn't feel happy being reunited with our ancestors, something, being able to touch something that they've created and to make those connections. At the same time, there was a lot of feelings of pain because of their displacement, because of their sort of neglect, the fact that they've been in the back of the museum under, you know, vegetation that grew around them. And for me, what was hard to sort of swallow was that they were adjacent to these, you know, piles of rubble from, I guess, past construction projects from the bishop. And so, you know, if they were any closer, who knows? Some people might not even be able to distinguish what was sort of construction debris and what were sacred stones to us. So, you know, it was a lot of those mixed feelings. But I think, you know, after several visits to the bishop, you kind of just move into a place of gratitude because you're able to actually physically be there to connect with them because you know what's coming up, which is we're all working towards repatriation efforts, or at least to get them cleaned and moved.
You know, you took some pictures and sent them to me, and I think I had that same reaction, was like, those aren't the lattice stones that I know, because they're pretty just in pieces, really.
Yeah, and they're not together, and they're kind of found throughout the Mariana Islands, including Guam. Like, parts of the TASA, they're not complete sets. That's what the curators told me. The TASA are actually in a storage facility at Bishop Museum, while the Haligi, which is the pillar without the cap, they were actually found behind one of the museum buildings, just one of behind the buildings. But like Elissa was saying, that these Haligi, they weren't covered in tarp or anything. There was debris and vegetation growing. But she did talk about the cleaning efforts that she was doing along with the Bishop Museum and the working group, the Guahan working group, along with the Hawaii working group, on trying to revitalize these stones. And then there are discussions of repatriation efforts. But with those working groups, the Guahan working group, they were trying to figure out how to move these stones respectfully because of the positions they were in. So talking to, for example, Sarah Kuaiva, she's a curator at Hawaii Pacific Cultural Center Resources at Bishop Museum. She said she had to hire a crane company just to move the stones, because these stones in particular, if you stand them up, they're 7 feet tall, but they all together weigh 5,000 pounds. So you can't just take a forklift and move them. But there were discussions of how to set up these stones. At first, they were going to create the stone set up in like as a sinahi, which is the crescent moon, and have it pointing towards the Mariana Islands to symbolize that they're returning home. But it was Alyssa's idea actually to have the stone set up in a circle with the tasa, which she calls a nana tasa, which is the largest stone there, to kind of symbolize this healing, and eventually they will return. But with Sarah Kuaiva, who is a curator, she actually describes what where these stones actually came from.
There are three lattice set and then four tasa that are at Bishop Museum, which are part of the reinstallation. And two of the sets came to Bishop Museum from Guahan between 1922 and 1924. The two lattice sets, we know which villages they came from as well. So one of them is from Orunau and the other is from Ipau. And then the four tasa also came from Guahan, also just came from different parts of the island, although we don't know what villages exactly. And then the third lattice set, which is actually the largest, that is a part of the reinstallation, came from Luta. And this set actually came to Bishop Museum's campus in 1979, and it was given from the Honolulu Museum of Art, which this lattice set was on its campus since 1951. You know, these lattice have been on Bishop Museum's campus for quite some time. There are generations of people who have been visiting Bishop Museum's campus that remember them. And specifically, Chamorros and diaspora remember them being on view as well. So they were last on view over 30 years ago. And so this is a really fantastic way to put them on view again, right in time for FESPAC.
So clarify though, how did these lattice stones get to Hawaii in the first place?
Some of the Lattie stones are actually part of the Hans Hornbostel collection. And Hans Hornbostel, he was an amateur archaeologist who was hired by the Bishop Museum to go to Guam and the Mariana Islands to collect these artifacts. So it's unclear how they got these stones, because these stones are sometimes over 5,000 pounds. There's no documentation on how they got there, but they did it somehow. But these Lattie stones were actually one of 10,000 artifacts that he took from Guam. So other artifacts that Hans Hornbostel took was pictographs that he chiseled in these caves that were actually sacred in Chamorro culture. And he also took pottery. He also took the Chamorro slingshots as well. So those are also part of the collection that's being talked about in repatriation efforts. But I spoke with Nicole Delio Duenas, who is a archaeological collections manager at the Guam Cultural Repository, and she spoke about some of the oral histories that were passed down about how Hans Hornbostel got these artifacts.
I think it was questionable and complex. There were instances that we've heard from oral histories that he would go to farms, he would be armed and say, we'd like to survey here. And so, you know, there's that sort of intimidation, right? Like if you're going with an armed Marine or an armed guard into a farm and saying, oh, we need to survey this. There was that. And then there was also, at one point, there were these sort of call outs to the community, you know, and saying, bring in an artifact in exchange for a movie ticket.
Yeah, it's all very interesting history, and hopefully Bishop Museum can tell that story, you know, as everybody gathers for FESPAC.
Exactly, and looking at the Lattie stones, I definitely got emotional seeing that for the first time. It was my first time seeing the Lattie stones in person.
Yeah, it's powerful, but lots of mixed emotions, definitely, to see it in disrepair. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio about the Lattie stones at the Bishop Museum and how they will be showcased as part of FESPAC. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we talk poetry to mark National Poetry Month. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line at 808-792-8217. You can find the Conversation Podcast on our website or look for us wherever you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.